Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Meat and Three is Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you highlights from Feast Portland, like our chat with the one and only Andrew Zimmern.
I'm super excited to be here because for people who do what I do for a living, we do tons of, you know, desk side chats and podcasts and interviews and stuff like that. And you circle the handful of ones in a year where you get to talk with people that you're really excited about talking with. So this is awesome.
We picked up on some recurring themes while talking to our impressive roster of guests, including the current state of Portland's food scene, personal identity, and believe it or not, the influence of great chefs' grandmothers.
Meemaw never touched a drop of booze in her life and now has a distillery named after her. But I grew up in her garden and just really, she taught me all good things come from scratch and women can be anyone they want to be.
So tune in for this week's extra special episode. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today, my guest in studio is Naz Duravian. She's a writer and an actor born in Iran. She grew up in Italy and Canada and now lives in Los Angeles with her husband and two children. She is the award-winning voice behind the food blog Bottom of the Pot and the author of the cookbook, also named Bottom of the Pot, which is on sale now. Welcome to the show, Naz.
Hey, good to be here. Thank you for having me.
To have you. I'm so happy you're in studio and you're in New York because you are promoting your book, which is so exciting.
I am. So happy to be in New York. It's very hot and humid.
It is very hot and humid. Probably more so than in California right now.
But we have fires California, so there's that.
It is a trade-off.
Yes.
Yes, you have fires and, I don't know, like a lot more smoothies and yoga and things like that.
Green juices.
Right, I recall. I'm happy you're here. And is New York the first stop on your book tour promotion?
It is. We launched in L.A., and it's New York and a few other cities to follow, San Francisco, Canada, Nashville.
Fun, good cities all around. And you're going to be at the 92nd Street Y?
I'm going to be at the 92nd Street Y on Friday, the 28th, in conversation with Nilou Mohtamed. I'm very excited about that one.
That is going to be a good program.
It is. I can't wait to sit down with Nilou.
That's going to be a fantastic conversation. Well, let's dive right in. I have your book in front of me. It is so beautiful, and your voice is so strong, and it's so clear, and, you know, I encounter a lot of cookbooks in my work, but rarely do I just get immediately sucked in and feel like I want to read the whole thing front to back, which is what I did with yours. It's such a captivating voice and story, and your food is so vibrant, and it just made me hungry the entire time. Let's start at the beginning. The result of the book it's kind of like the story of your life, beginning with when your family fled Iran in 1980 because of the revolution and the hostage crisis. What do you remember of living in Iran, and what do you remember of leaving Iran?
My memories of Iran are pre and post revolution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then there was the revolution in the middle. So pre, it was a very typical, normal family life of school, trips to the north, summer vacations to my father's side of the family. They're from the Caspian region, the Caspian Sea. My mother's family is from Azerbaijan Republic, not the Republic, but the Azerbaijan province in Iran. So there was a lot of family gatherings with lots of food and my school, and then there was a revolution. And it really does feel like everything changed overnight. And very quickly, we had to make this decision to leave, to
go. How like cognizant of that change were you? Because you were so young. I mean, how aware were you that things had shifted politically?
Aware of everything. Aware of everything. it's very different when I think of how I'm raising my children now and how aware we are of nurturing their emotional states and talking about things. When you're going through a situation like that, there's no time.
Right.
There's no time to sit down and have a family meeting and to talk about our feelings and how, you know, get in touch with our emotions. Everything is very heightened. And decisions are being made within seconds of what to do. So, and when I think of it, my parents at the time were my age now.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't even quite fathom how they did it, but I'm sure I would do it as well. It becomes about getting everyone out safely and hopefully with a promising future ahead.
Yeah, and kids are so sensitive to energy. I mean, you must have, even if it wasn't completely explained to you, or maybe it was, you must have really picked up on, you know, the anxiety and the fear that was, your parents were probably trying to conceal, I imagine.
But. Yes. I mean, looking back now, I do think there's probably some type of PTSD there,
yeah.
You know? But we did speak of things very openly. Politics, we spoke of very openly. How could you not? It was happening all
sure.
around us. So my political education and awakening happened at a younger age. I got to know about different countries, different methods of running a country, different governments. So it's not all bad. You take
yeah.
all that, and it's made me who I am today. So I'm grateful for all of it, actually.
Mm-hmm. It's who you are.
It's who I am.
And it's your book.
It is. It
and
is
your
my
blog.
Book. So the it's interesting that the food was the conduit to these stories.
Right.
It sparked these stories that maybe were dormant before, and food was my way back in.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what my next question was. You just kind of answered it, because I know first your family went to Italy, and I love reading about that because it's such, it just feels very, like, joyful, like that part. I mean, it was brief. It was a few years when you were in Italy, but, like, you had such amazing food memories there, and it seemed like such a happy place for your family because you had traveled there, you know, many times before, so it was, like, such a wonderful refuge and, you know, and Italian food. And then your family ultimately went to Vancouver. And I was going to say, like, once you got to Vancouver, it seems like there was a lot of ways in which, you know, you didn't have to explain who you were. Like, you wouldn't just invite people over to your home and they would eat your food. And then that was the story.
Right, exactly. So when we moved to Vancouver, I was 10 and we moved right in the middle of the school year. So it wasn't easy to make friends and, you know, coming from Italy and wait, but you came from Italy, but you're from where?
It's a lot for a kid.
From Iran.
Right.
And first there was that, having to fix that if it's not Iran, it's Iran. And then Persia, is that the same as Iran? You know, so there
sure.
was a lot. I get it. It was a lot for my little friends to wrap their heads around.
A lot for you to have to wrap your head around and then try and explain.
Yeah, yeah. I used to set up, when we had our after-school play dates, we played, you know, school. And you have a teacher and you have the kids. So I would teach, when it was my turn to be teacher, I would teach the kids the Persian alphabet, my little friends. And then it was dinner time, and at our home, it's whoever's over stays for dinner. And that's when, you know, the rice dish would come out and the stews, and my friends got to know me better through the food, I think.
Yeah, it makes sense. Can you talk a little bit about the food? I mean, the food that's in your book, the food you grew up eating, like what are some of the hallmark dishes of Persian cuisine, or the ones that, you know, you best remember eating growing up?
Of course, rice.
Mm-hmm.
It begins with rice. Rice is Persians have elevated the method of rice making to an art form, truly. It's different than other types of rice making, because in Persian cuisine, the rice is like, they should be like jewels scattered on the platter. So not clumpy. And then they're stained with this gorgeous saffron sunset hue. And then there's the bottom of the pot, the tadig, which means ta means bottom, pot means dig, and that's the crusty rice at the bottom of the pot where sometimes you might think, oh, I burnt the rice. Mm-hmm. It's the good stuff. You don't want it to burn, but you know, it's this lovely, crispy, buttery, crispy rice. And then if you have rice, you have all the wonderful, fragrant, flavorful stews that you serve with the rice. So it could be an eggplant stew. We use an abundant amount of fresh herbs, you know, just bunches upon bunches. And we make this stew called Khurash Qurma Sabzi, which is just parsley and cilantro and fenugreek and Persian dried limes and either lamb or beef, and beans, and it's very hearty and fragrant. That's another thing about Persian cuisine. So it's not just about what the food tastes like and what it looks like, but what it smells like. Mm-hmm. We always talk about the fragrance of the food.
Yeah, it's the idea of just having like a gigantic platter of herbs on the table is such like a exciting concept to me. But I mean, I wasn't even aware that that was like a dish in of itself, just a gigantic platter of like every herb you can come across.
So it doesn't have to be gigantic.
Well, in my head, it's gigantic. I guess in the book, it looks kind of gigantic.
It can be a simple platter of, you know,
right,
whatever you have hanging around in your fridge. Yes, we eat fresh herbs with almost every meal. You can think of it as it's the salad equivalent at the Persian table. The fresh herbs aid in digestion, and they help cut through the heartier stews or the soups or rice dishes. It's a fresh and crisp bite. So radishes, parsley, tarragon, cilantro, mint, Persian basil. And once you start eating fresh herbs with your food, you're never going to go back, I promise.
Right. Yeah. What about yogurt? You love yogurt. I love yogurt as well, so I was very happy to come across that chapter
yogurt
in your book.
Yogurt is my best friend forever.
I eat yogurt at most meals.
Me too. I eat yogurt when I'm feeling down. I eat yogurt when I'm celebrating. Mm-hmm. And plain yogurt.
Yeah.
I don't like the sweet stuff. That's like cavity-inducing. But yogurt is life.
Yeah. No, it's the plain, the tangy, the sour. It can be savory.
Cooling.
And yes.
It's cooling. So tangy, you hit on something there. We Persians love tang.
Mm-hmm.
And we use a lot of different bright acids to liven up the food. But yogurt is another, you know, it's another side dish, which if you have your rice and your stew, then you're going to have either just a tub of yogurt, or you can grate some cucumber and add some dried mint or fresh mint, and some, if you want to get really pretty with it and fancy, some dried rose petals, and that's a side. So for me, if I have my rice and stew, I have to have that yogurt.
Yeah.
On the side. And it's all services the perfect bite.
Right.
So you have a little bit of everything as it's all going into your mouth at the same time.
I really want to be an honorary Persian person. So you left Vancouver, kind of backtracking to your life, to move to Los Angeles to be an actor.
An actor.
An actor. What made you want to do that? And this is coming from someone who did the same thing.
It's all I ever knew.
Yeah.
It felt like it was all I could do, frankly. There wasn't another path. I was interested in acting since I was quite young, and then in high school it started taking off, and I had plans to actually move to New York. I studied here for a summer in my teens, but it just so happened that my uncle lived in LA, and there was a place I could sort of have a launching pad, so I ended up in LA,
mm-hmm.
and now I have never left.
Yeah. But you've kind of, I mean, you started a food blog when you moved to Los Angeles, and I'd love to hear about what made you do that, like in a serious way.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to school to study theater, but then ended up getting into food, mm-hmm. and that, you know, became my career path. And you've blended that in a really, it seems like, a way that's worked out seamlessly for you. But I think a lot of people go from theater to food, and maybe because, not in your case, but in my case and other people I've met, we end up working in restaurants. And that's kind of like the gateway there?
I actually never had a restaurant job.
That's fantastic for you.
But I had other, you know, side jobs, but not a restaurant job. I don't know what it is about going from, you know, the entertainment industry to food. But for me, starting the food blog was, I had my kids, they were babies, and I was getting a little frustrated with, you know, not knowing what I was going to do the next day and being at the beck and call of, you know, a call to audition or to go to work or not work. So I needed a place to be creative mm-hmm. and to be myself and explore what I wanted to do. And food was just my go-to thing. It was something that brought me joy.
Yeah.
So that's why I started the blog. It was also because the blog really started the same way, and in a way how the book started was at our kitchen table with lots of friends enjoying this food and everyone asking me for the recipes. And I got to a point where I got tired of like emailing people separately.
Right. You're like, need one place to direct
everyone.
So that's everyone.
What I thought. I thought, okay, I'm going to put it here and you can all check in there. And then once I started the blog, that's when these stories just very organically started coming out. It was like the recipes informed the stories and the stories informed the recipes. I don't know which really came first.
Yeah.
And I started enjoying it. I had fun with it.
Do you think it unlocked something for you as far as like reconnecting with, not that you'd ever given up, you know, your heritage, and you're obviously still very connected to it through food and your family, but as far as like finding the stories needing to come out and, you know, connecting with that part of yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I've always been very proud of my heritage, and we talk about when we have friends over and we're digging into the lubia polo, the green beans and chicken rice, and you know, people ask, oh, when, you know, how did this dish come about? And it's all start, well, when I was a kid in Iran, and then the stories come about. But through the blog and the book, all those things that we didn't talk about when we went through those moves, it's all starting to come out now.
Yeah.
And it's made me reconnect with my family, I think, on a deeper level too, and to ask some of those questions that were left unanswered.
Right. I want to speak more about that, but we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsor, and then we'll be back more with Naz.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world. Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hey, you're listening to Food Without Borders on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I'm in studio with Naz Duravian. She is the author of Bottom of the Pot Cookbook, which is available right now. So go get it as soon as you're done listening to this interview. Naz, we've been having a wonderful conversation about the stories of your life and your journey and how you got to the point where you started your food blog and eventually wrote your cookbook. The intro to your book is so beautiful. And like I said at the beginning of the interview, it just immediately pulled me in, and it's so vivid and gave me such a strong understanding of who you are as a person. And in the intro, you talked about how, like, the bittersweet quality of allowing the taste of Iranian food to unlock those memories of your past. So we had kind of just started to speak about that. But I want to hear more because it sounds like such a visceral experience that you describe, like walking down a hallway in your apartment building and smelling rice cooking, and it's just so complicated. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that the smell of the rice, if you've ever smelled Persian rice in the process of being made, there's nothing like it. It draws you in. And to me, that particular scent is home and family, without a doubt. And it's very comforting. It makes me feel, you know, loved and good and all of that. But it is bittersweet as well. So it's all the people that were left behind. It's my immediate, you know, my family that I don't get to see every day. In that intro, it's about my mother visiting and making that rice and all the families visiting. But I know that they're going to leave too. We live in different cities. And it's those years that we lost when we left Iran, you know. Who knows what I would have turned out to do? Or it's all those questions that you think, right. My goodness, what would it have been like? We would still be eating the same food, kind of.
Yeah, that's the constant.
But who would we have been as a family?
Where does your mom live now?
My mom's in Vancouver.
Oh, right. Do you go back to Iran ever?
I've never been. I've never been back. No.
Do you think of going?
Eventually, one day. One day.
I can tell just even by your face that it is so complicated to think about.
Yeah, not right now, but I hope to one day. I don't know what that would be like. I would be a tourist.
Sure.
It would be very emotional, I think.
Yeah.
To go back.
What would you, if you were to go back, what do you think you would want to do? Like, what would you seek out first? Or what do you feel like you have unanswered questions or curiosity about?
Honestly, I would want to go back to our apartment, which I don't think, you know, I don't know if it's even still there and what it looks like now. But that's the first place I would want to go back to. And then I would want to visit, like I had mentioned, Gilan province, where my dad's from, and Azerbaijan province, where my mom's from. And I still have some family there, too. So those are the two regions I would love to go back to and reconnect.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you this earlier, but, you know, you talked about how your parents had to make such a quick decision in fleeing, and there wasn't really time to even, you know, sit down and, like, have a conversation about feelings. They just had to act. And I'm sure you've thought about how you, as a parent, what would you do if there was a similar crisis and you knew that you had to make a quick decision? How do you think you would handle it as a parent with your children now?
Exactly like they did. Mm-hmm. They put us first. And I think as a parent, like you said, it's visceral. You don't even have to think twice about it if it involves your children. I think if it was just about yourself, myself, I would take a little more time. And, you know, weigh the pros and the cons. But when it comes down to your children, you do what you have to do.
Yeah. I don't know when you started writing this book exactly, but obviously it feels like a very dark and precarious time in the United States right now. Did anything come up for you in thinking about yourself as an Iranian, as an immigrant living in the United States? What sort of feelings came up as you were sort of reconnecting with that part of your life in the midst of what's happened in the United States post the election?
I wrote this book. It's taken about 2.5 years now. So exactly almost the whole process was during this very odd time that we're living through. It brought up a lot, but I had to be careful and consistent with telling my story without having all this, background noise, but what was happening, the breaking news stories from hour to hour and day to day. I really didn't want that to color this book. Mm-hmm. That's not the story I wanted to tell. But I couldn't help noticing as I was writing the airport story and what was happening around me with the travel ban, it was quite surreal, actually. Mm-hmm. And many times I had to turn off the radio, turn off the news, and just stick to my story and not let that affect what I wanted to say originally. I'm not a believer in, food will solve all our problems and we can all gather and there will be world peace. But I do think it can bring about conversation. It can open up dialogue. And that's very important. Once we stop speaking, I think we lose a lot.
Yeah.
We lose hope. And if we can do it while we're breaking bread, I can't think of a better way to do that. Food has this amazing effect of putting people at ease. I've seen it happen at my table, you know, when someone walks in through the door grumpy from a long day or LA traffic or whatever you have, and you can sit around, and it can just be a very simple meal of warm bread and feta cheese and all those great herbs and some walnuts. And Yum. That's all you need, and a hot cup of tea or a glass of wine. Mm-hmm. And everyone relaxes. Everyone's shoulders drop. So if we can do that, we have to keep conversing and sharing our stories, I think.
Yeah, I think that it's the perfect time for your book to come out and encourage more stories like yours and more conversations and highlight much more of our commonalities than our differences.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you read the story, I've had an average life in Tehran as a 6-year-old. It was probably much closer to yours than than we assume that maybe it's not. But I think if you hear these stories, it's like, yeah, we kind of did the same things.
Right.
You know, we went to the beach for summer vacations, and we're not that removed from each other.
Yeah, and certainly we've all had the experiences of, you know, coming home to certain smells and having that stir something in us, whether it's nostalgia or, you know, that bittersweet feeling, mm-hmm. of that complicated feeling of family and life and, you know, reconnecting with the place where you come from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any favorite, I'm sure they're all your favorite, but any just a couple quick recipes that you want to highlight in so we can go to those first.
So lubia polo is what I call our mac and cheese. Mm. In our house with my kids and my husband, it's the green beans. It's typically made with red meat. I make it with chicken. And it's so comforting, and I can't think of a better way when to spend a Friday night when everyone crashes through those doors and putting on a movie and sitting at the coffee table and digging in with a side of yogurt and some pickles and the fresh herbs and the tadig, of course, to munch through. That's our favorite. From the appetizer chapter, the borani labu, the yogurt and beet dip. It's just this amazing fuchsia color that brightens up any dinner table or for an appetizer spread. There are so many different ashes. Ash is like a soup, Persian soup, but it's thicker and it's heartier. The tomato ash is one of my favorites. The kebabs, we had this kebab party for the book shoot. The chicken kebab and the pomegranate kebab. Kebab torsh, they're delicious. The drinks, rose water, sherbet, is so fragrant and so, again, cooling for the summertime. It's so hot and humid in New York City, like we were talking about. The cantaloupe slushy, palude. That would hit the spot today. And all it really is just a really fresh, ripe cantaloupe with ice. And I drop a couple of drops of rose water in it and you blitz it. That's it.
That sounds
perfect. And it hits the spot.
What about for the colder months, which I'm sure, even though it doesn't feel like it, are soon upon us?
Abgusht. Abgusht means beef broth or, you know, beef water, really, that's what it, but it's broth. Mm-hmm. It's this lovely, very, it's quote-unquote poor man's food, mm-hmm. but it's very easy to prepare, and it's just it's meat and potatoes and beans, and you just let it, and lots of fragrant spices, and you let it simmer on your stove for about 2 to 3 hours. So you want that meat falling off the bones. It's the shank. And then you can either serve it as is, like a soup, like a thicker soup, or what we do is then we take all the chunkier stuff, so like the meat and the beef and all the beef and the potatoes, and we mash it. So you serve the soup part, and then you serve the mashed up thicker potatoes and meats, and it's kind of like refried beans, and you smear it on bread, and it's so good.
Yeah.
And it sticks to your bones.
The food in your book is so vivid, and you can tell it just smells amazing and looks, and the colors are vibrant. Like, everything about it just feels like just jumps off the page. So I really can't wait to start cooking from it.
Thank you. And I have to credit the photographer,
definitely,
Eric Wolfinger, for that. He just, you know, he got me and he got the food. And that's what I had said. You know, I said, this is vibrant food. Mm-hmm. So I need it to, I want it to jump off the page. And he got it.
Yeah.
From the first shot. It was pretty cool.
Tell us where we can follow you, or you can keep tabs on, you know, your tour and what you're working on and your blog, and just tell us how to keep in touch.
So you can find me at bottomofthepot.com, and I have all the events listed. I have a dinner coming up in San Francisco on October 7th, which I'm co-hosting with Comage and Chef Hanif Sadr of San Francisco. He's a wonderful young chef. I can't wait for that. But you can find all the info and tickets on Bottom of the Pot. On Instagram, I'm on Bottom of the Pot. Twitter, it's Bottom of the Pot 1, because someone took Bottom of the Pot.
Oh, damn you, Bottom of the Pot.
Facebook, Bottom of the Pot.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and for making time for us while you're in New York. Go check her out at the 92nd Street Y on Friday. And if you're in other cities, find her on tour. And whatever you do, make sure you go out and buy the book and cook everything. And I can't wait to go do that. Thank you again for coming on the show today. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Come back next week on Wednesday at 6 p.m. ET on heritageradionetwork.org, or find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify.
For listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.